All right, everyone. I'm Tanzina Vega, and here we are on The Takeaway, day two. On Saturday night, actor-musician Donald Glover, a.k.a. Childish Gambino, dropped a music video for his new song, This Is America. And if you aren't one of the more than 30 million people who've watched it already, the song sounds a little something like this. This is America. Don't catch you slipping, no. Don't catch you slipping, no. Look what I'm whipping, no. This is America. It's emotional, it's intense, there are lots of layers of symbolism, shooting, dancing. It feels like something you really have to watch more than once to understand and get everything. And by the way, listeners, we are going to be posting this video on our website and on our Facebook and Twitter pages today, so you can also find it there too. But joining me now to break this down is Ibra Ake, producer on This Is America, and he's the creative director for Childish Gambino and also works as a writer on Atlanta, the hit series that Donald Glover created and stars in. Ibra, so good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
So this video exploded on social media. Like I said earlier, I'm going to have to watch it a couple times to really get it all in. Talk to us a little bit about sort of the big ideas behind this. How long after Donald wrote the song did you guys come together with the visual images for the video?
It's interesting working with him because I feel like this is actually one of the older songs. He kind of just has things in his head. And when it's kind of album time, it's kind of like, okay, finish baking the cake you started. So we've kind of heard this for a while. The idea was just a We Are the World song, I guess. You know, there's a bunch of rappers featured, but he just kind of wanted to make a We Are the World song with rappers. And really not them rapping, just their ad-libs, just kind of reducing the features to jazz.
When you watch it, or when I watched it, one of the things that captured me was the violence is graphic, it's stunning, and it's very quick. It's a surprising, constant turn of events. And in fact, there's a lot of talk about how seeing these images are traumatic for Black Americans who already live these realities and see these realities, and now they're sort of reinforced in social media. And I want to read you a tweet by Brittany Luce, the host of Gimlet's The Nod. She said, and I'm quoting, "I think the thing I'm struggling with is that as a Black woman, I don't need to see images like those to feel enraged. I'm already enraged. I'm not trying to be cynical here, but I can't help but wonder, who is this supposed to provoke?"
I definitely feel her. You know, I've had a conversation. I remember, you know, there was an incident where this guy had a breakdown in New York and ended up shooting a cop. I just remember that was kind of the first time during the Black Lives Matter protests and things where we've always known as a community there's violence towards us. And just in America in general, it's not just limited to Black people. But I think, yeah, I just think that's just the nature of where we are, and we don't control that. You know, I have a lot of people of color who, when we're seeing a lot of images of violence, especially against us, have to take a break and cry in the bathroom and go back to work. That's just part of, you know, life in America. And I don't think what we did was remarkable in, or different than my daily life in any way. I think we just talked about it to a broader audience. But Twitter is doing that to me constantly. I don't see any kind of, when I hop on my feed, I see a million images of violence.
Now, you know, we're talking about the impact that this video and watching repeated trauma of Black Americans has on Black Americans. How do you think this video is going to play out differently with other audiences, white audiences, for example?
I definitely see it's uncomfortable to watch, but I really can't tell. Like, I can never. I mean, I think as a Black man, it's really hard to predict what white people are going to think of what we make. And I think even with working on Atlanta, we try not to think about that. And I think, I mean, I've talked to Donald about this a lot, but we talk a lot about, as creators who are kind of marginalized with our voice, we try to make stuff in a vacuum, in a way where we're not influenced by what was made before us, which usually in the media specifically comes from like a white world and a white infrastructure or a system that is controlled by white people. So, you know, even with this video, we kind of reduced it to a feeling, a very black feeling, a very violent feeling, but also a very fun feeling. Like, you know, if you're at the club and there's a shooting outside, you still have to go get food afterwards, and you have to compartmentalize that. Like, being marginalized is compartmentalizing trauma to exist in the world. Like, I can't stop being black because of trauma or discrimination. I still have to live life and forge on. And maybe we take that for granted, but I think that's just part of the experience.
I think you're tapping into what I was feeling when I watched it was a wave of emotions. There's a great Huffington Post article that, and I suspect more of these to come, that really breaks down the different imagery that's in it. It's everything from the warehouse, where they say this is supposed to sort of embody what you're talking about, systemic white supremacy and oppression. Are they on the nose about that?
Yeah, we actually just thought this wouldn't be as big of a deal as it would be. But I think when we make stuff, we think of it as a dance. So we put our opinion down, and how people respond to it and what they see in it kind of informs us and actually gives us a better idea of ourselves. So it's not a simple of like we know everything we're doing, but we just kind of know the feeling we want. And a lot of times we don't even have the tool to kind of explain what we're feeling, whether that's like happiness or anger or sadness or joy. But I think when we share that, it kind of people, you know, there's a commonality there and people can relate to a lot of this stuff. And yeah, a lot of the stuff they write about is dead on. But I don't think we are as cerebral or like calculated as people think. But I, you know, obviously people picked up on, you know, the like Donald's dancing and like
as in Fela Kuti, right?
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Fela Kuti, but like there's a little bit of like Jim Carrey in the mask there and like a minstrel like attitude to it, you know, like even being on set there was a lot of just be this is bad, but like, yeah, just be that kind of like old school, like vaudeville, entertainish, like coonish smile. But I think it's not simply that. Like, yes, that is Jim Crow-esque, and that is a reference that has affected us. But that's also the Gwara Gwara dance in itself, which originated in Africa. And, you know, it's a bunch of kids who are people who live, I mean, not necessarily that like Africa is a poor place, but people are still dancing and happy and like expressing themselves in that way without the same kind of like politics attached to like presenting a black body. Yeah, in that way. But it's similar movement in a way, but the context in an American space versus like an African space is still kind of telling the same story of like enjoyment and joy besides this like really complex to digest background. So I think it's also important we include the diaspora narrative, because this isn't, I think part of This Is America is kind of being like, this is the world also, like America isn't above the rest of the world.
You mentioned the children in the video, and I remember as I was watching it being so nervous for these kids in not in real life, but in the image of the video. I kept thinking, what's going to happen to these kids, right? There was a tension there that just had me concerned. It almost felt like what we live every day, the violence that's inflicted on young black Americans every day was coming through emotionally for me there. I was feeling a lot of things. I necessarily didn't see joy, but I saw joy that was, maybe it was joy that was ready to be interrupted, and that was the tension that I kept seeing.
Oh, definitely. I think that's actually a great sentence. I think that's part of just life in general, and that dial, I think it's dangerous when specifically when you start going into, like, black people versus white people or gay versus, you know, mainstream, like, sexuality, like, joy, your joy being foreign to others it becomes a more dangerous risk of interruption, and it's just so it creates a moment of tension because you kind of, you know, there was a group of black women that were kicked off a wine tour for laughing too loud.
And off a golf course.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, even our joy makes people uncomfortable. And I think even with the video, I think people are focusing on the violence, but I also want to stress that it's about stuff like that. Like, it was important to have, you know, D shirtless because it's like, yeah, that's how we dance. That's like your uncle in Nigeria who drinks harp. And like, you know, that reference of Fela Kuti doesn't stop at Fela or stop in like the 70s. Like, that is part of expressing yourself. And I think it's just our goal is to like normalize blackness. And I feel like we don't really think of it in that like editorial way. I think it's just like, yeah, this is how we would like to dance, but we have to be aware of the danger and the politics of how we're perceived and the implications of the history of how we were treated and the responsibility against current events and current times. There's all this math you're constantly doing, expressing yourself. And I think in general, I think we're trying to kind of not have to explain ourselves to other and just exist and not censor what our existence looks like as people.
But that's at the core of the American, particularly the black and brown American experience, is not being able to exist as people solely, right? And I feel like that's also what you were talking about in terms of, you know, having to be, as marginalized people have to compartmentalize their lives and their feelings.
No, definitely. I mean, I grew up in Nigeria. I was born here, grew up in Nigeria. And moving back here, and a lot of my friends feel this, there's a lot of, you know, I'm allowed to have conflict with someone who's different than me, but it's like, oh, is this like an actual difference in personality or is this like racism? And even just the math of constantly trying to categorize interactions makes being black just that much more exhausting. And I'm sure like, you know, identifying as a woman makes that so much more exhausting. And I think that's why it's important that we all express our true selves, especially for those who don't have a voice, just so we can be understood better. And like, and I think it's not enough that people understand that about like the bad stuff, but people also have to understand the good stuff, how we have to balance the good and the bad stuff. And not just for white people to understand us, but for us to understand each other. Like, that's a lot of This Is America is kind of, you know, bridging the gap with the diaspora.
This work quickly became social media fodder. And like I said, people have dissecting it almost in the way that they were with Get Out, right? Like seeing all the symbolism behind it and trying to understand everything. And it's been called a work of genius in many ways. What's next for the team?
I think next for the team, we're focusing, I mean, hopefully making another music video people like, even if it's maybe not as salacious as this one. And I think, yeah, I don't know. I don't think we've honestly had a chance to think of that. I think probably just wrapping up the new music that's coming out. And I think we like to keep stuff under wraps, but there's more coming. And we like to think of ourselves as like the Avengers every time we can assemble. And all our schedules are in line. And so that's happening right now. And we're working like rapidly to just get as much out as we can, especially this last run to really, yeah, just really like make a big bang, you know, because this is Donald's last album. And so, yeah, but we have some good stuff coming up for you guys.
Ibra Ake, producer on This Is America and creative director for Childish Gambino, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
This is America. Don't get you slipping, no.
All right, what do y'all think?
His persona and song hold a mirror up to us in this United States. We have strayed so far from a nation of values where everyone is considered worthy of equal consideration and safety. Whole swaths of our country are considerably worse off after generations of neglect, racist and classist public policies, and poor access to health and housing. When will we pay attention by reversing these still active ideas to create lasting change? Thank you, Artist Glover, a.k.a. Childish Gambino. This is Holly Freeman in Portland, Oregon.
I loved Donald Glover's new music video. Not only is it just playing good music, but the direction and the cinematography was outstanding. The message behind was, of course, the utmost importance, and I look forward to whatever he comes out with next. My name is Lily, and I'm from Eugene, Oregon.
This is Trey from Atlantic Beach, Florida. And as a long-term fan of Childish Gambino, his videos have always had some kind of message, and you really have to analyze the work to get the message. And this latest one is a great resemblance of America's art of distraction and violence in the country. And I love seeing the feedback that people give on the video and the meanings of the symbolic representations in them.
This is Liza from Lafayette, Indiana. I think it's a profound and necessarily in-your-face work of art that forces the audience to face the exploitation and killing of Black people in America. The song is also mesmerizing, and I can't stop listening.
Heartbreakingly accurate. Reminds me of several Rage Against the Machine songs created to help people, quote-unquote, wake up to the reality of how our country slash the world truly operates. Contraband, 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 contraband. I got the plug
on with Hawker. Whoa, they gonna find you like Baka. So thanks to you guys for weighing in. Again, if you haven't seen the video, please, you must. Go to our Facebook page and check it out and let us know what you think. Or you can give us a call here at 877-8-MY-TAKE or record a voice memo using our neat new recording tool. You can also find that at thetakeaway.org/mytake. And up next, another look at the United States and what it means to be working class in this country. And later in the show, we'll talk about the downfall of New York's attorney general and how President Trump is reshaping the nation's courts. All that coming up right after this.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. It helps us in ways you can't imagine. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter and they'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And on Monday, my first day hosting the show, we kicked off a series of conversations about identity in this country. Conversations about how we define ourselves and how we think about ourselves as Americans. And it sparked a lot of reaction from you, our listeners, and many of you brought up the issue of class.
Broke.
Privileged.
Middle class.
Poor.
I'm in the top 5% of income earners, so there was an American dream, no longer.
Working class.
You hear that last one? Working class.
Well, I think it's really important that we keep in mind that this is a term that's always been politicized and subject to debate, and it's changed dramatically over time. I think in the simplest way, I think we can use the term to mean people who survive by selling their labor as opposed to people who own productive capital.
William Jones is a professor of history at the University of Minnesota and author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. And he says that we've been getting this label wrong for almost as long as we've been using it.
In many ways, the term working class has become a shorthand for a white male industrial worker. And I think there's two problems with that conception. One is it's outdated, that we live in an economy that has shifted dramatically from manufacturing to a service economy. The typical worker in the United States, it's somebody who works in the service sector, probably in a sort of caring or a cleaning position, probably a woman, probably non-white, an immigrant. So in that sense, the way in which we conceive of the working class, and particularly when we associate it with a white male industrial worker, it's outdated. But it's also, in many respects, never actually been an accurate image of what the working class was. In the 1950s and 60s, which was the peak of manufacturing in the United States, only about 1 in 3 wage workers actually worked in manufacturing. The rest worked in agriculture and in services even then.
And the working class, or specifically the white working class, was something that came up in our last political cycle a lot. Were the white working class as an idea or as a group used as a straw man by the media or by the administration in some way?
Well, I think it's a really interesting moment because in the past really 50 years, the term working class has really fallen out of political debate. So it was pretty striking to see the term reemerge really at the center of political debate. And yes, in some respects, it was used in two ways. One, used as a shorthand for a white male factory worker, or in some respects, a sort of extractive worker, a coal miner. I think it also was a way of hearkening to a debate over upward mobility, the sense that the working class was in decline because we've seen the decline of economic mobility and upward mobility for American workers, which reflects a true trend, a real trend that we've seen since the 1970s. And so that term, I think, became a sort of shorthand for talking about a loss of opportunity for American workers.
Or for a very specific set of American workers, because I think that the media narrative around that the white working class was one of empathy, at least initially. And I had really never seen that type of empathy, or really broader definition, as you say, extended to working class Americans who happen to be black or brown.
Yes. I mean, that's interesting in the way in which I think the sort of the anxiety, the sense that American workers are experiencing a decline is something that is true for American workers across the board. In fact, for non-white workers, for women, that sense of decline is actually more pronounced.
I want to take a caller that we had this week and take a listen to what they had to say.
This is Harold from McKinney, Texas. When I used to work for a technology company for 35 years, I considered myself middle class. At age 54, I was laid off, and now since then, at age 59, I have not even been offered a full-time job since, and now consider myself older, working class, poor.
Is this a trend that we're seeing more of? Are more people falling out of the middle class into the working class?
Well, certainly, and I think, you know, this represents this sort of declining prospects, economic prospects for American workers really since the 1970s, and an important part of that is declining access to things like pensions that allow people to have to sort of maintain a certain level of economic security even when they're out of work. You know, it's interesting that if you think about the way in which the caller framed his class identity, he became working class when he lost his job. So working was not something that he associated with being working class. In fact, working allowed him to be middle class.
Let's listen to another caller.
Hi, this is Jason. I'm calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. My biggest identity that I share myself is class. I think about it daily. It shapes my financial decisions and how I raise my two young boys. It shapes my perspective in politics. Getting buried in credit card debt seems to be the norm for most middle class families who own a home and have two vehicles and need to get to work. And maintenance and repairs are both crippling as well.
Will, do a lot of Americans identify more in terms of class today, like our caller, Jason?
Well, I think we have seen a slight uptick in the number of people who identify as working class. But I do think that we've seen, really since the 1970s, the sort of average American has seen their income flatline and really only maintain by working more. So we've seen people take on more jobs. We've seen particularly women increasing their participation in the labor market, which means that Americans are working more since they were in the 1970s and earning less or roughly the same as they would have in the 1970s. And that has increased a sense, I think, of this sort of overall sense of class identity or economic anxiety.
Politically speaking, is there the potential for these two groups, the white working class, the black and brown working class, to unify politically and to move towards some change here?
If we look at policies back to the mid-20th century that actually addressed economic security, those types of policies, I think, hold promise today. So things like federal laws that made it easier for people to form unions and bargain collectively, minimum wage laws that actually kept up with the cost of living, which our laws do not do now, a robust system of Social Security, public education and healthcare. These will help people in the working class find levels of economic security that they've lost since the 1970s. But I think it's also important to keep in mind that those policies in the mid-20th century were applied very unevenly and favored men and favored white workers. So I think it's a matter of, in some ways, learning from the past and building on those models, but making sure that they are not discriminatory and exclusionary in the way in which they were in the past, and I think in the ways in which they, you know, have reinforced inequalities that really stay with us today.
William Jones is a professor of history at the University of Minnesota and author of The March on Washington, Jobs, Freedom, and the Forgotten History of Civil Rights. William, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
5 days ago, literally just 5 days ago, New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman put out this video about the life lessons he learned working at an abortion clinic as a young man.
So I learned an important lesson at a young age. If a woman does not have the right to control her own body, she is not truly equal. And if a woman does not have the right to control her own body, she is not truly free.
Well, last night, Schneiderman resigned from his post after stunning revelations from four women who say he physically assaulted them. Two of the women went on the record for a story first reported by The New Yorker magazine and gave reports of being choked and repeatedly hit by Schneiderman. Both sought medical treatment as a result of the physical abuse. Prior to this, Schneiderman cast himself as a champion of the Me Too movement and of women's rights, and his office is pursuing criminal charges against Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. With us now is Zach Fink, the Albany reporter for New York One. Zach, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
So I want to start by reading you part of the of what Michelle Manning Barish told The New Yorker about a violent encounter she had with Schneiderman in his bedroom. And I'm quoting here, "All of a sudden, he just slapped me, open-handed and with great force, across my face, landing the blow directly onto my ear. It just came out of nowhere. My ear was ringing. I lost balance and fell backward onto the bed. I sprang up, but at this point, there was very little room between the bed and him. I got up to try and shove him back or take a swing, and he pushed me back down. He then used his body weight to hold me down, and he began to choke me. The choking was very hard. It was really bad. I kicked in every fiber. I felt I was being beaten by a man." Zach, please tell us a little bit more about your reaction to that and these allegations.
Well, I have to say, Tanzina, it was just absolutely stunning how quickly all of this moved. I mean, this came out a little bit before 7 p.m. last night, and within about 3 hours, he had resigned. I mean, that was in between all of that, just a complete storm on social media from elected officials here in New York calling on him to step aside. You know, Schneiderman's initial reaction, at least the quote we were given, he hired a crisis communications person, and I believe it was the same quote that was in The New Yorker, was he tried to pass this off as some kind of role play, that this was some sort of fantasy he was engaged with. And, you know, just talking to people, you know, observers and pundits and other elected insiders here, you know, they were like, that's just a really bad defense, and that's just not going to fly. And that seemed to maybe even perhaps accelerate what he ultimately had to do, which was step aside.
And this is someone who's really styled himself politically as a champion of women's rights. He pushed for anti-choking regulation as a state senator in 2010. How does this connect with what we're hearing today?
Well, you're right. I mean, he won awards. He was lauded by women in the party as a champion of women's rights. Women's right to choose was really one of his major platforms. He brought it up at almost every turn. You know, he also, Tanzina, I think this is worth noting, that, you know, really made a career in the last year or so of going after the Trump administration and standing up to Trump, something that was very popular politically here in New York City. But, you know, it also brought some critics who said that he was a little too focused on that and not exactly doing what the state attorney general should be doing. But Schneiderman always seemed to have a very political agenda, whether it was standing up for women's rights, a woman's right to choose, or going after the Trump administration in as many different ways with as many different lawsuits as he possibly could.
And we actually, to your point, we actually have a clip from the Samantha Bee show about that particular point.
We beat him on travel ban one, we beat him on travel ban two, we beat him on environmental regulations and the transgender military ban, and we will continue to fight.
Yeah, you are a superhero.
No.
Not so much these days, right, Zach?
Yes, right. Not all heroes wear capes. I mean, look, you know, sometimes it's one of those things where sometimes the loudest voice is the most obvious person who's actually quietly undermining women's rights, who doesn't actually have respect. You know, this seems to be one of those instances where the public persona that Eric Schneiderman had was, in fact, the complete polar opposite of who he actually was as a person. Now, look, these are allegations. We don't know that they are true. There would presumably have been a much more public vetting process had he tried to hang on to his job. job. The fact that he resigned so swiftly, I think, you know, the story sort of becomes, at least here in New York, politically speaking, what happens next, who's going to be up for the office.
Well, let's talk about that, because there's a couple things coming. I mean, he is deeply involved in the Harvey Weinstein case. He was reviewing the Manhattan DA's decision not to prosecute Weinstein in 2015. So how do these allegations and his resignation and Schneiderman's resignation affect the suit against Weinstein?
You know, it's a very interesting question, Tanzina, because last night when the governor, Andrew Cuomo, who very quickly called for him to step aside and told us also, his office did, that they were going to appoint a prosecutor to immediately commence a criminal investigation. However, they ran into a small dilemma because the Manhattan District's Attorney's Office had been ordered by the governor to be investigated by the AG, by Eric Schneiderman's office, because of their failure to prosecute in the Harvey Weinstein case. So it created a conflict. You know, you have all these prosecutors investigating one another. So the Cuomo administration taking a more cautious approach there, that they may appoint a DA from another borough, for example, to look into this. But, you know, you basically have both of their offices investigating one another.
What happens now, Zach? Who's up for AG in New York? Where do New Yorkers go from here with this change?
So today, the state assembly will meet, and they will meet again tomorrow. We don't expect a decision right away on that. But the short answer is the assembly Democrats, who are the majority conference in Albany, will make the determination here of who will fill that post. The assembly Democrats have 104 members. There are 213 members of the legislature, so they will need 107 votes, which means they'll have to get three, most likely from Senate Democrats. And once they have a consensus, that's it. I mean, the governor can have some input, you know, just in terms of conversation and who his preference might be. But ultimately, it is the decision of Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, and he will say it'll be a member-driven decision, and they will determine the candidate. Speculation on who that could be, you know, they may put one of their members just as a placeholder, because there is a primary coming up in September, and there's likely to be an open primary no matter what. However, the odds-on early favorite is New York City public advocate Letitia James. I was told by Democrats that she is, quote, primary proof, could be a consensus candidate that emerges here, Tanzina.
Once again, Eric Schneiderman out as New York Attorney General. Zach Fink is an Albany reporter for New York One. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we head over to the other side of the legal system, the courts, and look at the opportunity President Trump has to fundamentally reshape the nation's judiciary. And if this is the best second episode of a podcast you've ever heard, and I'm assuming it is, then we'll need you to tell the world by writing a review on iTunes and rating us as well. If it's not, we need you to also tell us that. Help us make your takeaway podcast awesome by letting us know what you think. And thanks. Now let's get on to one more story today, huh? Every year, there are thousands of cases that are appealed to the Supreme Court, but ultimately, the court only hears about 80 cases, which means a lot of big decisions are being made one level lower at the Federal Appeals Court. Take the travel ban, for example.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had actually upheld a nationwide injunction on the first version of the travel ban that the president had announced in January of 2017.
Or lesser-known cases like this one from the Fourth Circuit in North Carolina.
In July 2016, the Fourth Circuit, a court of appeals, struck down North Carolina's voter ID law that critics said it was an effort to depress African-American turnout at the polls. It had required photo ID and it would not allow same-day registration on Election Day, but that law was tossed out by the appeals court.
That's Sungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post. And the reason why we're talking about these lower courts is because this week, the Senate is set to take up six of President Trump's judicial nominees. And since taking office, the president has been working to fill a record number of judicial vacancies left by the last administration.
You know, when I got in, we had over 100 federal judges that weren't appointed. Now, I don't know why Obama left that. It was like a big, beautiful present to all of us.
That's the president speaking back in March, and so far, the administration has already confirmed more circuit court judges than any of the last five administrations at this point in their terms. Sungmin Kim told me that President Trump should be happy about all the vacancies, but President Obama is the wrong person to thank.
He is completely accurate when he said it's a big, beautiful present to Trump. It wasn't exactly from President Obama. It was actually from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who controls what goes on the Senate floor. And what McConnell engineered was basically a very rapid slowdown of confirmation of judges in the last 2 years of Obama's presidency. What Mitch McConnell does is play that long game, and he wanted to save all these vacancies, particularly in the appellate court, for a future Republican president. Remember, at the time, we weren't sure who the nominee was going to be in 2015 and then in early 2016. But Mitch McConnell's gamble paid off for him, much like it did for when he basically obstructed Merrick Garland's nomination to the Supreme Court. McConnell is the main reason why President Trump came in with so many vacancies in his presidency. I believe on day one, on January 20th, 2017, the president had 108 federal vacancies to fill, and it is now up to just under 150, and that's for district and circuit courts nationwide. So there is a lot of opportunity here for the president to really reshape the courts in a much more conservative direction.
And there are six appeals court nominations that are being heard this week alone. Can you give us a sense quickly of who the six nominees are and what regions they're in?
So there are six who are supposed to get Senate floor votes this week. So there is one from the Fifth Circuit, which is considered the one of the most conservative appellate courts. We have three from the Seventh Circuit based in Chicago, one from the Sixth based in Cincinnati, and one from the Tenth in out west near in the Colorado region. And they don't seem to be drawing much controversy over their legal views or what they may have said in the past. That's a lot of times what Democrats have pointed to when opposing Trump's judicial nominees. But the one nominee I'm watching who's getting a Senate floor vote this week is Michael Brennan of the Seventh Circuit from Wisconsin. And the reason I'm watching him is because there's been a lot of fight over process in the Senate. And Michael Brennan is one example where Senate Republican leaders have decided to proceed on his nomination with a confirmation hearing and with a confirmation vote on the floor, despite the fact that one of his home state senators, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, who's a Democrat, has not given essentially permission to advance the nomination. There's been this century-old tradition in the Senate called the blue slip rule. What happens is that when there's a judicial nomination from a certain state, the nominee's home state senators send literally a blue slip of paper back to the Senate Judiciary Committee as a sign that says, hey, it's okay to go ahead with this confirmation hearing.
Wait a minute. So we're in 2018 and we're still dealing with blue pieces of paper?
Exactly. It's a very the Senate is a place where we're dealing with blue slips of paper. We vote with pen and paper and thumbs up, thumbs down. The Senate just voted to allow babies on the floor for Senator
Progress.
Tammy Duckworth. Exactly. It's a little slow behind the times, but things are changing.
What about Ryan Bounds in Oregon? You mentioned Brennan, but what about Ryan?
So Ryan Bounds is getting his hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday. And the reasons why he's so controversial is similar to Brennan, but Democrats say it's even worse because he doesn't have permission from either one of his home state senators to proceed. Ryan Bounds is from Oregon. Neither Ron Wyden nor Jeff Merkley have returned their blue slips to the committee to allow that nomination to proceed. He's a young conservative lawyer, could serve on this appeals court for decades. He has also come under fire for some pretty controversial writings that he had produced while as an undergraduate at Stanford University. I will make clear that Ryan Bounds has apologized for those writings and disavowed those writings, but regardless, Democrats and liberal outside groups working to kill his nomination have pointed to those writings to say that is unacceptable for a lifetime nominee.
Now, the Ninth Circuit Court, which covers California, Hawaii, Alaska, Arizona, and a bunch of other states, has a reputation for being liberal. But they also make some very significant decisions, like striking down President Trump's travel ban. Why does the Trump administration have its eyes set on the Ninth Circuit? And does Bounds' nomination fit in with the rest of the judges on the circuit?
It has its sights on the Ninth Circuit precisely for the reason that you said, because it has stymied so many of his initiatives. We were talking about the travel ban. The district judge in the Ninth Circuit blocked also his sanctuary city's executive order. So that's become a real target of the president's Twitter ire, especially. He's tweeted about the Ninth Circuit at least four times during his presidency. But it's also been a long time target for conservatives who say, first of all, this region is way too vast. vast. It's the largest in the country. It needs to be broken up simply for the workload alone. But the reason why it does lean so liberal is because it expanded significantly under the Carter administration, and appropriately liberal-leaning judges were appointed during that time. And now conservatives say they're now just starting to kind of course correct the leanings of the Ninth Circuit. And Ryan Bounds, who has a clear conservative track record, he's a member of the Federalist Society, which is the powerful conservative coalition of potential judges and lawyers, clearly certainly fits into that model of what the president is trying to do to the courts.
And if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Sungmin Kim of The Washington Post about the push to fill judicial vacancies under the Trump administration here on The Takeaway. Sungmin, I want to take a step back. Each president has an opportunity to fill judicial vacancies that can essentially reshape the judiciary. And how much has President Trump taken advantage of his political power in this process so far?
He's taken some advantage of it so far, but in terms of where the White House and Senate Republicans have kind of targeted which courts to fill right away, they've actually, instead of trying to turn liberal courts conservative, they've actually, in what they've done so far, is shore up the conservative breakdown of some of these courts. Because if you look at the judges who've been confirmed so far in the first 15 months of the Trump presidency, a lot of them do come from appellate districts where they were already leaning conservative. We're talking about, for example, the 5th District in based in New Orleans, which is considered the most conservative circuit court in the country. A lot of that is just kind of by design. We talked about the blue slip rule earlier this year, and a lot of these conservative states have two Republican senators who are enthusiastically on board with the president's nominees and can subsequently move forward these nominations much more quickly. And that's why he's also kind of been slow going on the Ninth Circuit. And you're hearing that a lot from conservative activists who care about the courts, saying the Ninth Circuit has been liberal for too long, and the president actually has been sitting on his hands a little bit in trying to change it.
What will these six nominees go through? And at the end of the day, what impact is that going to have on the appeals courts should they be approved?
They would have, I mean, each individual appointment to the circuit court can last decades because these are lifetime appointments. What the White House has done is pick out actually people who are younger. You know, we talked about Ryan Bounds earlier. He is only 44 years old and he can serve on the Ninth Circuit Court for a very long time. So it's the fact that these conservative jurists could, you know, make their own stamp on their respective appellate courts for decades that gives the president such lasting power. Mitch McConnell talks about how he loves the tax law. He's proud of the tax law. But if there is a Democratic Congress, they could easily vote to repeal it or overturn it. But what he's doing to the judiciary will last for generations. And another thing to watch, too, is that a lot of the 15 appellate court judges that the president and Senate Republicans have gotten confirmed this year and last year, a lot are on President Trump's Supreme Court shortlist that he released during the campaign. And so you see how the administration is grooming a lot of these people for a potential Supreme Court vacancy that we're always watching out for, especially this time of year.
Is there a disconnect in what average everyday Americans understand and know about this process and the appellate courts as opposed to what you and I might be more familiar with here? Is there a lack of transparency or understanding in how this process goes through?
There's a lot of that. And also just a lot of what the appeals court does just doesn't get covered because, you know, there are so many decisions. There are 13 appeals courts who are all doing interesting, important, various things. And so much of what the coverage on rightfully is what the Supreme Court does, because obviously the Supreme Court's decisions are the law of the land and they make decisions that last for generations that are monumental changes in how this country functions. But remember, as we talked about earlier, only a tiny, tiny fraction of all legal cases make it to the Supreme Court. About 99% of cases stop at the appellate level. So that's why it is so important for people to get to know kind of the power of the courts. But it's hard to portray that work and kind of show what they're doing day in and day out.
And what else should Americans watch out for or be aware of, should I say, with the Trump administration's impact on the courts going forward?
I think it's just knowing whether you are a supporter of the president and his efforts on the judiciary or whether you're an opponent, just realizing just how much power there is and how much power these individual judges have. And they're already, you're seeing some of his earlier appointees already making an impact in their own respective circuit courts. And a lot of times, since there's so many that are going through the Senate at any given moment, we talked about 15 already being confirmed so far in the under the Trump presidency, and 6 more this week and next week alone. Oftentimes, there isn't a lot of public vetting unless there is a massive screw up by a judicial nominee during a confirmation hearing. So a lot of times, these judges just don't get a lot of attention. I will fault the news media a lot in that, but I think just kind of paying attention to the impact that each individual people can have, whether they stay on the appeals court or whether they're elevated to the Supreme Court in some way. These people are very powerful and very, you know, especially relative to their power, very unknown.
Sungmin Kim is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Another day, another dollar, another Takeaway podcast in the books. I'm going to keep telling you how you can reach me until we're pretty much pen pals. So you can find me on Twitter. I have lots of thoughts, and honestly, it's the best way to reach out to me directly, which is at Tanzina Vega. And we'll be right back in your podcast player tomorrow with another huge Takeaway podcast. Thanks for listening. Talk to you mañana. This is Tanzina Vega for The Takeaway.